Did most Chinese like to live close to other Chinese before the war?
Well, I think the circumstances put the Chinese here, because first thing is that when you have no need to learn the English, because in fact you're limited to your opportunities, so the only place you can find your work are in very menial jobs where you don't need to use English. Say if you're like a janitor, you don't need to have contact with the customers at a store. You're at those kind of jobs where your contact is limited to only maybe taking instructions. You're not doing day-to-day conversation or articulating in English. So you don't need it, so you don't need to develop your language. That's number one. Number two is that familiarity. You know, you're not accepted in any place. But I told you before, right around the time the war, my sister wanted to get a house, our family wanted to get a house. West of Main Street, they were denied.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? If we don't have it, no space, no all that. So that, and of course, if you don't learn English, you have a familiarity of language. You hear a lot of Chinese people spoken. They go to Wenqiang Long, which is still there, before World War II, or Yingqiang Long. Much of the language is Chinese. So you have that. So the people are there because somebody is familiar, they can communicate, and their needs are served by the people there, because the people who serve them also speak the language. So you find very little need for people to go out. And if you did have it, you're limited because they wouldn't sell to you. There's certain people moved out and were able to get, if you have a lot of money, it's usually easier. But when you're down at the below low class or middle class as far as income, or below, lower, upper lower or something, you're really going into a lot of these what I call blue collar, wave the American flag with all these Americans, and there are a lot of prejudice involved. Many times in the higher income, when you're up in the higher upper 10%, you can move in a lot of places. There's less bigotry. Maybe because of the fact that people who have money never see who's moving in next door anyway, because usually they live in such large mansions they can't see down the street.
Mm-hmm.
This is a facetious remark. But I think you'll find that many of the Chinese who live in those kind of places, those areas, are able to move in. But when you get down to the lower income, then you have problems, especially with the majority group.
Would Chinese move if the neighborhood changed?
I think it might, because it's a kind of a two-sided coin, the question there, because if you don't have the economic circumstance to move, you can't, you're locked in, okay? Because many people who live in Chinatown are there because they can't move out. They can't afford it financially. And I would say, generally speaking, Chinese will move if they are the brunt of the crime or any type of other things in certain areas. I mean, the Crenshaw area, that's middle class. A lot of Chinese have moved out because of the change. The crime rate has gone up and things like that. And maybe they moved out. And I think it would still be over there, because it was a very, nice community. But I know for a fact that we used to live there, and quite a few others lived up there because of some of the circumstances that took place. And then we needed an extra room, so that's another excuse to move. But I think you'll find that some of them moved because the change in the community. And if the forces which move in become, if the some of the influences were the new forces come in, make the people there become victims of those, you know, negative forces, then things do change.
Mm-hmm.
People do move. And mm-hmm. It's true with other people, but I think most of the Chinese, you're talking about Chinese in the lower income, yes, many would like to move out because of the conditions. I think if Chinatown, look, you take that example, people would not move out there if it was a community, like, you know, with houses and such, where there's enough lots and space, and also the people were able to buy into that. But you'll find that the situation is such that even before the prices had gone up, 1960s, mid-60s, when prices began to rise because of the influx of the Chinese, you find people were still moving out when they could because of the fact that due to the demography, the makeup of Chinatown, there's more business, and the people there weren't able to buy into much of that stuff because they were kind of more like apartments and things. And many people, when they could afford it, they would move out. But if all things being equal, you know, there's an area that's, you know, raising the level of the housing and such, and affordable, like where they're going to,
mm-hmm.
I think many of them would remain.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just like a Nelson Moy. You know Nelson Moy?
No.
United Poultry?
Oh, yes, I know that, yeah.
He has his Taj Mahal up here about where Castlebar School is on College Grove, about 2 blocks up there. And Nelson said, well, I move here, I stay here because, you know, first thing is it's accessible to where I work.
Mm-hmm.
But he can afford it, you know. That thing is worth about $250,000 then when he built it about 15 years ago, and now it's probably worth them, you know, half
mm-hmm.
of whatever it is, or $750,000 just the house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he says he built it there because he likes the area, it's all right. He said, what do I want to move over to Beverly Hills? He said, I can afford to go to Beverly Hills, but I won't, you know, it's not familiar to me. I find friends are here and such, and it's also close to my business, and I like the area. So, you know, it's just a matter of economics. And if it's available, Chinatown is unavailable, so they move out. Or you look at 9th Street, San Pedro, or 22nd, 20th and San Pedro, or it used to be the old Chinatown, the three main areas. People were pretty permanent and stable over there, as long as the area was at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And once a change takes place,
mm-hmm.
when people start to become more financially able, or their income becomes greater, then begin to think of moving out, because I think the level of the community, you know, is different. And then it actually began to change anyway, because on the 25th Street, we moved one ethnic minority came in. Now it's beginning to change again.
Mm-hmm.
Change to Hispanic, and some Chinese are moving because of the, you know, Indo-Chinese, some
mm-hmm.
people are moving in and all that. But still, those, you know, whether stability of an area will remain as long as the economic conditions are, and the, you know, community doesn't change as far as ethnic makeup. Usually it changes because the new arrivals are usually there at the lower rung of the island. And usually the Chinese are in an area, especially when you're in a lower income area, the new arrivals are usually at the lower level of
mm-hmm.
income.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they're lower class of people, but, you know, they're lower income, and then there sometimes problems arise because of people who have nothing coming in less than the others. There may be problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it forces the others out.
Okay. Where did most Chinese men meet their wives?
Well, I don't know about the older people, but the young people. See, the thing is, it's a problem, because I knew for a fact that I knew some laundrymen, and they were single people, and they had a very difficult time meeting women, because there's really a dearth of women compared to men in those days. I didn't know that fact until I made a study, but I was wondering why people had such a hard time finding women, you know, for, you know, meeting prospective brides. And some of them went back to China and got them. I don't know how they got them over here because there was still the limitation, you know, mm-hmm. the Exclusion Act was really in effect
mm-hmm.
After World War II. But some of them married and brought their wives back. Now, how they did, I don't know, because I'm not too aware of some intricacies. And some went out of town and San Francisco and other places and somehow located women, whether a picture bride or they planned it before. But most of us, like you say, we went to high school. Those who went to school here were fortunate to have a nucleus. Most of us, many of us, met the Chinese women, except for myself. So I don't know why, but I was maybe more interested in doing other things, playing, you know, sports and going to work and then starting school before the war started.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that some of the fellows met the women in school, but they were very, the instances were few in those days because you're limited to those socials, like these record hops and such. It's part of it. And church, the Kong Church, and the Methodist Church, and the Nazarene Church.
Did Chinese marry within generation? For example, second generation would marry second generation, and so forth.
Generally speaking, yeah. Yes. Generally speaking, yeah. But you know, you can't make a generally speaking, it tended to be that way. But you see, you know, like anything else, something which doesn't hold true, doesn't conform to the generality.
And what about Samyup marrying Samyup and Seyup marrying Seyup? Was that important at all to American-born?
Most of us go to Samyup.
Yeah.
See, most, in fact, practically everybody came over here. The majority were Bongtoy Sanwa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know my parents and some of the others were very strong for a Chinese marrying a Chinese, but more so that the person was stable as far as, economically stable, where they had a good job or come from a money family or something. They're very conscious about that, because I remember my mother used to talk to other friends. It just takes me long to her visits because I was the youngest. I guess she won't leave me at home or something, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So your parents were against interracial marriage?
I guess the Chinese, let's just say. But there were some, you know, married outside, because I know a few married Japanese as I look back. But those are, you know, few. It happened, probably Japanese marrying Chinese too, but comes, you know, women, men, and so forth. The man being at that time the pursuer. Nowadays, you know, today it's either way.
How was interracial marriage viewed by the Chinese in general before the war?
They did look at it very favorably, especially if you marry another minority.
I mean, it would have been better to marry
a non-Asian minority. Because a lot of times they weren't, you know, they talk about other people. Gee, you know, so-and-so married another minority, non-Asian minority. They kind of shake their head or kind of make some kind of remarks. And
is that because they think they're better than some of the other minorities, I wonder?
Well, if you look back at Chinese history, culture, we're the middle country, you know, and everything revolves around. And Chinese are very close. And they say, you know, I had people remark and say, how come the Asians are Chinese and even get born very racist? Well, no, I say, well, everybody has something. They think we're the best people in the world. And I believe it. We invented a lot of things, you know, we were the, you know, a lot of culture, you know, the basis of culture came from China in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
We look at all the other cultures surrounding China. We invented paper and everything else. So, mm-hmm. you know, I have a lot of... So I tell these people that. I said, I don't see why, you know, we shouldn't be saying we're above everybody else as far as our culture and everything else. I think that kind of runs off into our feelings, being that we are that kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
We've done so much. Our civilization, we were civilized before people came to America.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Europeans are uncivilized compared to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the cultural, historical, you know, the contribution and advancement, it's in spite of the fact that China's never gotten together as far as having all these little civil wars and, you know, but that's another side. I'm just telling you about our other backgrounds. See, culturally, we're more advanced and all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my view. I'm telling them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why we should be proud.
Okay. Did American-born Chinese feel it was important, just as important, to have sons as the older generation did?
Well, you know. All, I guess, you know, the thing is, you're talking about a generation which is close to the generation in World War II. Not talking about generation today, no. Today, I don't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow up in an environment, you know, of traditions which were, you know, people talk about it and live a lot of it, you know, you can't help but acquire some of it, unless you actually run off somewhere and hide in a cave or something. But I find that a lot of the things that our family believed in, you know, like, whether it's good or bad, you know, they used to tell me, you know, you got to listen to your older brother, or you don't, you got to, an adult is being taught, you listen, all that. I'm not that hard line, but I think there's, you know, this kind of runs into, you say, well, you know, respect and everything else. I mean, this is one thing, you know, I don't get it. To require my kids to say, well, I'm talking, you listen, all that stuff. But then, you know, when you do talk, they listen anyway. A lot of times you're a parent. But I'm saying that, you know, you can tell the kids that, you know, when your older brother is speaking, you're younger, you better, you know, listen to everything he says.
Right.
But I think a lot of the traditions that, my parents have, like, you know, these, like, you know, extolled us, so-and-so had a son and all that, oh, they're so lucky and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Have three sons. And all that. Oh boy, you know. But you know, being a parent, you always try to have, you know, to have a son. Fortunately, I have a daughter too. But I think it kind of works for me. You know, always look and say, boy, you know, you tell the guy, you say, I got a son, you know.
Yeah.
And my daughter is, she's no, you know, I never put her down. She's a woman. Very assertive. She'll tell me off. She didn't tell me off that way. She said, oh, Dad, you know, she'll criticize something. You gotta do it this, you know, just, you know, you're wrong or something. You know, this is, you know, at least they tell it. You don't say you're wrong, you, and that's it. But, you know, this is right, or, you know. But I think it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get away from yourself. You're close to your family at all. You have a relationship where you don't run, or like, you know, in the 60s, 50s, when they had all these hippies and they divorced themselves from the family, ran away, and, you know, they just rejected all the values. That, you might, but a lot of these people have come back. You know, you look at Mario Savio with the California, you know, the Cal, all that, the People's Park up there back in the 60s, early 60s. You know, all the walkouts at the University of California, right? Mario Savio and that.
I wasn't here in the 60s.
Well, you heard about that.
But I did hear about
that. Well, you know what? He's teaching school at LA City Schools. He was a leader up there in the walkouts. All this, you know, thousands with cities and all that. You know, when you become a teacher, your teaching group is a pretty conservative group. You know, and when they say teach, you go, people go to teaching because they're, I didn't think that. Just that I couldn't get into medical schools. I wasn't teaching as a next line. But, you know, I was waiting. And after I got it, I just forgot about it. It's people going because of security. You want security. So how, here you see, you know, here a guy is. So a lot of times people do have a tendency, you know, of course they say older people really tend to be more conservative, go back to, you know, the liberal conservative scale. So some never go back. Some people never grow up. Whether you go back to be growing up or not, I'm not sure about saying that. Some people just never grow up. They're in a fantasy, you know, they're fighting the Don Quixote, they're living, you know, in their minds. I don't say that people shouldn't be speak their mind, being assertive or aggressive, but I think my kids are, you know, a lot of things that we stand for, they also.
Mm-hmm.
My son still says, thank you, Dad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to say give it to them. Some people just take it, or, you know, sometimes you say, you're welcome. My daughter said, you're welcome. We practice it, too. When they're kids, we say, you're welcome. Thank you, we say, you're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
It begins because you can only practice with you. You practice what you preach, and usually it does better. It's better that way than to say, you do as I say, not do as what I do with that attitude.
Right.
Our kids have grown up, generally speaking, we're not perfect. We try to do what we say, and so they do what we do. We found that for our kids today. Oh, you know, they're not perfect, but they still say thank you, they still call us. Sometimes, like my son, just last week, we went to the UCLA game, and UCLA lost to Oregon State. And my wife said, hey, what are you going to call up your auntie? He said, you're not coming to the birthday party, son. He left and not. He said, oh, I don't want to go. They don't have to, you know, I'm not going to go if he went home. Yeah, he's a member of it. He came by and had dinner. So yesterday he came by the house, Saturday he came by the house. He called my sister up and said, thanks for inviting me. Tell the kids, oh, it's good that you guys did. Oh, we're off of it, you know. This thing. But he still did it. See? You know, he walked out. Some kids don't do it. They'll say, oh, I don't care. I don't want to go to that party, you know. Call them, you tell them. Oh, I don't care. They walk in, they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, see, I think, you don't chastise them and jump all over them. But I think, going back to you know, kids today, whether they have traditions, I think depends on the parents. Whether these things you believe in, practice it. Because, you know, some pick up, you know, a lot of young people going to take Asian studies, Asian American studies, and all that to learn about themselves. How much of it it's going to, you know, absorb into them, I don't know. A lot of you just kind of circus, and you kind of the interest is, you know, different levels. You're just going there just to find out what it's all about, whether you're going to stick with you or you're not going to join the circus, but some will.
Mm-hmm.
Some young kids, they want to become the fire eater or the sideshow worker, dancer, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but I think all this depends on the experience that we've had when we were growing up.
Mm-hmm. Did American-born Chinese like you feel it was important to send children to Chinese school?
We did. We sent all three of them. But like I say, I think that the problem is the fact that the peers did not speak Chinese. And we didn't speak too much at home either. We spoke English at home. And we, once in a while, my wife would say something in Cantonese to me, mostly to my son. The kids used to catch it, but no. But see, their peers don't use it, so they don't find any utility, value in it, or practicality of it, so they don't use it. I guess if you're living in Chinatown, and half the kids are still, you know, like a Castellar, they have a, right next to a Castellar school, they have a Chinese school, Zhongguohao. So the kids go there. Many of them, you know, they're not fighting. Well, of course, maybe they don't like it, but they're not, they're still going there. You might find more utility value, but you go to Castellar school in the playground, a lot of times you hear a lot of kids calling, hollering out in Chinese,
mm-hmm.
in Cantonese.
How many years did you send your children to Chinese
school? Well, the oldest one went a couple of years, and my daughter went about less than a year. They just said, you know, oh, God, you know, I don't want it. What are you going to tell a kid? Go! Because they're already going to school, doing well in the, you know, school, in the public schools. The youngest went for a little while. Then the youngest got a little bit interested, so he took Mandarin by himself at SC for about 2 years, almost. But now that's 2 years ago, almost. He just graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So he was pretty good. He's writing everything. He wrote a letter down San Diego to my in-laws, and they were still living.
Mm-hmm.
But he probably forgot 90% of it.
Very easy to forget. Many Chinese who first came over here just came over here to work, and then they went back to China to retire. About what percentage went back to China?
Very few. I can't give you a percentage, because I think one of the reasons we didn't have a retirement system, you know, the Social Security was something that's new, and a lot of Chinese didn't work in the Social Security system. And when you think of it's a matter of economics, one thing. People were unable to afford. Maybe if the Chinese were, of course, there's two ways of looking at it. If you make it here, you're not going to go back. If you're on the borderline, you know, you have no savings, such, it's very difficult to go back. Some went back. I know, I can't name names, but I know. My mother used to talk about someone with a box, something, you know, went back to China to live and all that. No, very few. But most people stay here because they were working, and this is a living. And maybe back in the village, I don't know how the village situation was, but from what I gather, it's not a place where you're going to make a living, you know, financially. Person, they went back there, they still have to have some means,
mm-hmm.
in order to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most of the people were precluded from going back because of the economic situation. Most of the Chinese here were very, you know, the older people were very, worked at low, what do you call it today, more menial type work. And the pay wasn't good. When you look at, I mean, in comparison, like today, you know, where you're at, you're really at the lower income bracket.
What did American-born Chinese think of going back to China, either for a visit or to go to school?
Well, most of them think about going back to China, going to school. Most of the time they went back because their parents sent them back. And a whole bunch, Charlie Kwan went back. You know Charlie Kwan?
You mentioned the name last time.
Charlie, because his wife used to live right down the street from me on Town Avenue, and they were the only Chinese. They never talked to her. She works up here now. She's my friend. She said, gee, you sure stuck up. It wasn't that. I was just bashful. Anyway, I know that whole bunch. Henry Ong went back there. Young Jew went back there. Everyone, the parents sent them back. Charlie Kwan, he ran away from school for about, I don't know how long, because he just didn't like it, went back there. Wilbur Wu went back, you know, Wilbur Wu, the captain.
Yes.
There. But he was one of the older guys there, so the older one got all the privileges, like Henry Ong, you know, he's about 5 years older than I am, I guess. He's over at the CFO gas station.
Mm-hmm.
They'll
mm-hmm.
talk to him, too, because he's been here a long time.
Mm-hmm.
His father owned a grocery store down the Black area, so he used to work out there. He gave you five other Chinese grocery stores in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, Eddie Ong, had a grocery store until just the last 15 years, because he got rid of it right down the Black area.
So American-borns didn't really think about going back at all?
Most of us did. There are very few. Let's just, maybe if a family is well off, and we didn't have too many, you know, Chinese who were that financial, you know, we didn't have upper middle-class Chinese as many. Yeah, a few importers and so forth, and a few, you know, people making money, but there are very few, percentage-wise, you know, less than 1% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you or others that you knew of think of the way Chinese were portrayed in American movies?
Well, we did see too many movies, okay, with Chinese, but some of the times we weren't, see, the, at that time we saw the Charlie Chan movies, we saw the, I don't know if we have, I never saw a Fu Manchu movie until after the war, okay, so the Charlie Chan movie, the thing is that, you know, we used to say, at that time, about the fortunate individuals like Anna Mae Wong and Key Luke and who were playing, you know, the number one son, they were talking about how fortunate they were having a job too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and then we looked at that aspect that the person was able to, you know, we looked up to them as being fortunate individuals to gain employment in those industries. And that was really, really far out, you know.
And being well known.
To be well known and to be employed. We didn't know how much, you know, remuneration they were making, but we find out later that actually the jobs that he looked at was like a side job. They had to hold on to another one in between.
Uh-huh.
It didn't afford them that much.
But you really didn't think about